we have a special offer for Issues Etc. Reformation Club members. If you join or upgrade your membership in our monthly or annual giving program during January or February, we'll add the new Concordia Psalter to the list of current membership benefits. T-shirts, books, broadcast transcripts, and advertising for your confessional Lutheran congregation. You can find out the benefits of being an Issues Etc. confessor, apologist, reformer, or patron at issuesetc.org. Look for the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses. Or contact Craig, 618-223-8385, or Craig at issuesetc.org. Join or upgrade your membership in the Issues Etc. Reformation Club in January or February, and we'll send you the new Concordia Psalter along with your other premiums. The Issues Etc. Reformation Club. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We've been doing this series on the history of Christian Confirmation. I learn a lot doing this program every week, and sometimes, you know, we deal with a lot of subject over the last, 17 years of my time here behind the microphone. You do kind of relearn things. You learn it once, and then you forget it, and then a new guest comes along and teaches it to you. This series on the history of Christian Confirmation has been a real eye-opener for me. I probably should have known this stuff. The information was out there, but it's all been brought together by our guest, Pastor Mark Serberg, in an excellent series of articles titled The Weird and Wacky History of Confirmation. And by the time we're done done talking about the history of confirmation, you start to wonder about why we're still doing it. I even had a conversation this last week when we were at the symposium in Fort Wayne, Indiana, with a pastor who said, you know, you're done listening to all of this. And he was talking about our conversations up to this point with Pastor Serberg, and you wonder, should I be doing the rite of confirmation? Is there a better way to do it? And that's a huge question we'll be answering here in the conclusion of our series with Pastor Serberg on Christian confirmation and its history. Now, you can join us with questions or comments. We are giving away to the listener with the best question or comment Albrecht Peter's 5-volume commentary on Luther's catechisms. It's a $225 value. It will go to the listener with the best question or comment during the next hour and a half as we conclude our series with Pastor Mark Serberg. Our call-in number 1-877-623-6943. We are coming to you live this Tuesday, January the 27th, 1-877-623-6943. Send us an email with your questions or your comments, talkback@issuesetc.org. Send us a tweet at @issuesetc, or you can use our Facebook fan page. We've left space there for your questions or comments on confirmation, facebook.com/issuesetc, facebook.com/issuesetc. Joining us to conclude our three-part series on the history of Christian confirmation, Pastor Mark Serberg, pastor of Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Marion, Illinois, and author of a series of articles titled The Weird and Wacky History of Confirmation. Mark, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on again.
This is a tall order, but I'm going to ask you to do it anyway before we start taking questions from our listeners. Can you, in just a few minutes, 3 minutes or so, can you take us on kind of the down and dirty drive through the history of confirmation up to this point?
Okay. basically, by the second century, we know that this belief develops based on the account in Acts 8 that an additional giving of the Spirit is necessary through the laying of hands or through an anointing, but that which involves often the bishop who's going to do it, sometimes a presbyter. From that belief in the baptismal rite, you just get this anointing and laying on of hands. And then during the Roman development of the Roman baptismal liturgy, they developed the practice of having two anointings, one by the priest and then one by the bishop. And during the 7th and 8th centuries, as that practice begins to get initiated into Gaul, it meets the language of confirmation, actual term, and together those combine to the belief that you have to have a bishop who is actually going to anoint an individual in order to give them this additional gift of the Spirit. And a theology develops to try to explain what this gift is. It's the belief that it gives some strengthening to the Christian. It has nothing to do with catechesis. It has nothing to do with teaching. It is simply a blessing that the bishop goes around and does whenever he is present. So that's the form of confirmation at the time of the Reformation. Luther and those of his school of thought did not continue using a rite. They simply had catechesis. When a child was ready to be examined, and part of the instruction was taking place at home, part was taking in catechetical teaching that took place at church, they would be examined by the pastor and then begin to commune. However, at the same time, or about the same time, Martin Bucer introduced in Hesse a form of confirmation which was new. It took first catechesis, and then it led up to a rite of confirmation, which said you're ready for baptism. And these sort of continue on as parallel models with the form with no rite of confirmation, the sort of really Lutheran one, being the dominant one. But this other version always was around. And as you enter into the age of Pietism in the late 1600s and then into the age of rationalism in the 1700s, their theology found this model of catechesis followed by a rite of confirmation to be very amenable, and they took it up, and that really then, from during the 1700s, becomes the dominant way that confirmation and catechesis is done in the Lutheran Church, and really takes on the form that we have sort of, you know, known it during most of our lives.
One other question before we get to our listeners. People will say, well, you know, before this thing developed, before this thing kind of took on a life of its own, and I think that's what you're really describing there in broad historical terms, to get to where we are today, what was the church doing in terms of how did they understand Christian instruction from baptism to the Lord's table? What were they doing as far as we could tell?
Well, instruction would take the form really focusing on Ten Commandments, Lord's Prayer, and the Creed. And that is the parish priest is obviously seeking to teach that in sermons. Parents, to the extent they're able to, are trying to teach that in the home. When children reach an age, and it varied from the Fourth Lateran Council, 1215 on, but usually between 7 and 12, somewhere in that range, that children would then begin receiving the Lord's Supper. And confirmation often actually followed after first reception. There was no hard and fast rule, but typically it was more common during most of the medieval period for children to be receiving the sacrament before they're actually confirmed.
Okay, so let's see what our listeners have to say. And again, our call-in number 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. Our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org, talkback@issuesetc.org, our Twitter address, @issuesetc, and our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. We begin with Ethan, who listens in Indiana. He says, can and should we move from the view that catechesis is simply a course of instruction in the 2 to 3 years prior to the rite of confirmation to a view that catechesis is an ongoing formation in the Christian life as a member of the communion of saints? What are your thoughts there?
Well, the answer to that is absolutely yes. I mean, that should be the goal, is to see that the mandate our Lord gives in the Institutes of Holy Baptism is to make disciples by baptizing and teaching. And that teaching, of course, is something that's going to continue on all through life. And so while certainly there may be times when it is more focused and more organized, we certainly want to teach people that it is going to be ongoing throughout life. And that's probably one of the weaknesses of the way we do it now, is when you concentrate it in this 2 to 3 year period, you know, right around middle school, and this is sort of the first time that we've done any kind of, you know, serious teaching, and then we sort of confirm you, graduate, and you're done. That's not sending the message this is an ongoing thing. And I think a much better model would be one that seeks to have periods of catechesis that extend during the course of the time when they're still children and also youth in church. So a period of catechesis that would probably prepare for First Communion prior to confirmation, and then some period of catechesis later, maybe in the middle school years or maybe in the high school years, that would take it up in a you know, more refined and developed way. But that way you would be teaching that this is not something we just do once and we're done. And, of course, the other thing beyond that is to continue to integrate the catechism into the life of the congregation and with adults for them to see that it's something to continue to be used. I will be the first to admit, when I finished confirmation, I thought I was done with the small catechism. And when I left Concordia Ann Arbor to go to the seminary, I definitely had no interest in the small catechism because that was, you know, beneath me and behind me. When I went to seminary at St. Louis, it was Dr. Nagel who couldn't stop quoting from the small catechism. And at some point it dawned on me that if Dr. Nagel is not done with the catechism, I shouldn't be either. And I think that is also part of the puzzle, is simply getting people again to see, and that certainly is happening, I think, in our church, to see the importance of the catechism as a text and the small catechism as a work, and the role that it has in continuing to shape and form our piety all through life.
Pastor Mark Soderberg is our guest. We're concluding our three-part series on the history of Christian confirmation with him taking your questions and your comments on this Tuesday afternoon, January the 27th, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. Send us that email right here in the studio. Include your city and state. Talk back at issuesetc.org. You can send us a tweet at issuesetc or facebook.com/issuesetc.
Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Collinsville, Illinois is happy to support the Christ-centered, cross-focused ministry of Issues Etc. Join us for worship, Bible classes, youth ministry, and other opportunities to grow in Christ. We have a Christian day school for children in preschool to 8th grade. We are located at 1300 Beltline Road. Call us at 618-344-3151 or visit www.goodshepherdcollinsville.org.
Did you know that we send out an email each week that details upcoming show topics? It's available for you to include in your weekly church bulletin. Just click the Issues Etc. Journal logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, and sign up to receive the church bulletin blurb. It's an easy way to invite your fellow parishioners to listen to Issues Etc. issuesetc.org. Look for the Issues Etc. Journal logo and register to receive a weekly bulletin paragraph from Issues Etc.
Continuing education for the confessional Lutheran. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. The Lutheran Church of the Good Shepherd in Greenville, South Carolina. St. Paul Lutheran, Chatfield, Minnesota. St. John Lutheran, Napoleon, Ohio. First Lutheran, Lufkin, Texas. Concordia Lutheran, Sikeston, Missouri. Hope Lutheran, Granite City, Illinois, Trinity Lutheran, Gladson, Alabama, and Lord of Life Lutheran, Chesterfield, Missouri. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. Journal. issuesetc.org. Click support. The Issues Etc. 300. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Pastor Mark Soderberg is our guest. We're concluding our series with him on the history of Christian confirmation, taking your questions or your comments on the subject of confirmation, whatever they may be. He's pastor of Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Marion, Illinois, and author of a series of articles titled The Weird and Wacky History of Confirmation. You'll find a link to those at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Mark, this question comes from Eric in Pennsylvania. He says, is it too much to put the responsibility on the parents to train up their children in the small catechism and determine when they should be examined? I think that that would eliminate the problem of rightly discerning who comes to the sacrament of the altar based on age, an unbiblical distinction. Would this create disunity in the synod? He's speaking here of our church body. A reason that I have been given as to why we practice it the way we do. There's a lot there. What would you say, Pastor Soderberg?
Well, for starters, we should just recognize that in terms of just using the small catechism in the home, that clearly is not doesn't go beyond what parents are able to do. It certainly doesn't go beyond the intention of the work to begin with, all those sections that begin, as the head of the family should teach in a simple way. So to use it at home, it shouldn't be an issue, and I don't think would be. In terms of determining when a child is ready, while we want parents to be involved in sort of recognizing that, they're certainly not being asked to do that solely on their own. In my own parish setting, I mean, I know the children, I have a sense of who I think probably is going to be ready and who I expect to hear from. With parents had questions, even to come and just talk to the pastor, because your pastor has a good sense of what the children are like. So parents would not be out there completely on their own. And I think some of this is just it's a foreign concept to us. We're just used to, it's lockstep, seventh and eighth grade, that's where you're going to go. And so the notion of doing things with my child and coming to some sense that they might be ready to receive the sacrament is just very foreign to us. In terms of the disunity of practice, I think we already have within our agenda, which is the book that accompanies Lutheran service book. It contains the other kinds of services and rites that are done in the church but don't typically occur on a Sunday. We have a rite for early communion before confirmation, and so we already have as a church body begun to introduce that, and so there will be some diversity of practice in that way, and I think maybe just some tension because we're sort of working through these things, but I don't think where pastors are taking seriously the catechesis and the need for children and youth to be examined before receiving the Lord's body and blood, I don't think it should create great disunity.
Now, I guess one of the things I'm concerned about, and I'm deeply concerned about the unity of this practice, whatever it may be, the emailers talked about the use of the small catechism in the home, and that is certainly to be encouraged. It was designed for use in the home, as you just pointed out, but I'm equally concerned about the many, many congregations that don't use the small catechism in church.
That would be a problem. Yes. To recognize that the small catechism continues to be the basic text for forming us in the faith. In fact, in my congregation, we have our opening announcements before the service, and actually as part of those opening announcements before the service, whatever part of the catechism the youth are working on that week, we actually all together read it out loud. And so every single year we're working through the catechism together. And to sort of recognize that has to be a focus. When I hear that there are congregations that aren't using the small catechism or at least not even really focusing on the small catechism in their catechesis, that has to raise serious concerns because if the Augsburg Confession is the foundational confession of the Lutheran Church, certainly the small catechism is the foundational teaching text of the Lutheran Church. And if we are to be united in believing the same thing, then we certainly want to all be working, with that one text. And it is a tool which is both simple and profound. I mean, you can go on forever. You can write a 5-volume commentary on the thing if you want, or you can also, discuss it in a very simple way with a child. And so its flexibility is just, marvelous, and to not embrace that is just foolish.
Well, and actually, I mean, aren't we really talking here about whether or not a congregation, I mean, this is a bit of a field from our general discussion, but I think it's related, whether or not a congregation wants to remain Lutheran. If they say, well, we're not going to use Luther's catechism, we're going to use this Christian instruction, youth instruction from some evangelical publishing house, does that raise a deeper concern than even confirmation instruction, or we should say Christian instruction?
That just goes to a basic issue of catechesis and what are you teaching? I mean, are you teaching people to be Lutheran and to confess what Lutherans have always confessed or not? And I agree that entirely is the problem. And when you see people wanting to, keep the name Lutheran but use non-Lutheran things or get away from those things that historically have defined and shaped Lutheranism, I mean, that's a very valid question.
We're talking with Pastor Mark Soderberg, the conclusion of our three-part series on the history of Christian confirmation, taking your questions and your comments on this Tuesday afternoon, January the 27th. We'll continue to do so into the second hour of the program after this break. Our call-in number in this break is a great time to give us a call with a question, any question or comment you might have on Christian confirmation, its practice or its history, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. Send us an email. Include your city and state, please. We'd like to know where you listen. Talkback@issuesetc.org. Talkback@issuesetc.org. Send us a tweet at @issuesetc. And you can go to our Facebook fan page. We have left space there for your questions and your comments on the history of Christian confirmation and confirmation practice. We are giving away the 5-volume commentary on Luther's catechisms from Albrecht Peters and Concordia Publishing House. It's a value of $225. It goes to the listener with the best question or comment. Our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc, facebook.com/issuesetc. Speaking of good instruction, the Issues Etc. journal is out, and I've written an article. It's actually part two of an essay called Lord's Day, Lord's House, Lord's Supper. Just some simple teaching for you, and you can subscribe absolutely free at our website, issuesetc.org. Look for the big red button. Click there. Enter your email address, and you're subscribed to the online Issues Etc. journal. We'll be right back.
Education and edification. You're listening to Issues Etc.
We have a special offer for Issues Etc. Reformation Club members. If you join or upgrade your membership in our monthly or annual giving program during January or February, we'll add the new Concordia Psalter to the list of current membership benefits. T-shirts, books, broadcast transcripts, and advertising for your confessional Lutheran congregation. You can find out the benefits of being an Issues Etc. confessor, apologist, reformer, or patron at issuesetc.org. Look for the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses. Or contact Craig, 618-223-8385. Or craig@issuesetc.org. Join or upgrade your membership in the Issues Etc. Reformation Club in January or February, and we'll send you the new Concordia Psalter along with your other premiums. The Issues Etc. Reformation Club. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're concluding our series on the history of Christian confirmation with Pastor Mark Soderberg for the remaining hour of Issues Etc., taking your questions and your comments, and we'll be giving away to one of our listeners with the best question or comment, Albrecht Peters' 5-volume commentary on Luther's Catechism. It's a landmark work, and it's a value of about $225. It goes to the listener with the best question or comment, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. Send us a tweet at @IssuesETC, email talkback@issuesetc.org, or our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. Pastor Mark Soderberg is pastor of Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Marion, Illinois, author of a series of articles titled The Weird and Wacky History of Confirmation. Listening in Arlington Heights, waiting on the line, Millie. Millie, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you. My question is, do you feel that the completion of catechism causes the loss of high schoolers and college students in the church when they feel that they have completed the catechism and that's all they need?
Thank you very much, Millie, and thanks for listening up there in Northern Illinois. What do you think, Pastor Soderberg?
Well, I think that really goes back to the broader problem that we were talking before about the fact that catechesis has to be treated by adults in the congregation as something that is ongoing. You know, when you see large chunks of the congregation who don't come to Bible class, it's kind of hard to sell young people on the fact that, you know, ongoing teaching is supposed to be happening. And so you can't lay all of this at the doorstep of, you know, catechesis or confirmation or any of those things. Some of these are just basic problems of the fallen nature. What we need to do is to imbue in our church, you know, the attitude that learning goes on, that the first time through is just the first time through, and that there will be more to be gained the next time through, and also that, you know, as we grow, it's just like coming back to Scripture itself. We have new experiences. We have new understandings. We're able to see things there that we didn't see before, understand it in a way that we weren't understanding it before. So I have all the time, as you know, parents who are going through catechesis with their children, as we do it in our setting here at Good Shepherd, who will say, you know, I heard this the first time, but I didn't get all of this out of it then, and I see things so differently now, and they're glad they're being returned to it, and that really needs to be the emphasis that we need to really sort of drive home in our church life, is that this is a continuing source of teaching and guidance and nurturing in the faith that is we're never going to exhaust. And that's where the model of confirmation that we have used, with this very, very strong emphasis on a terminal event and a rite that finishes it, has sent the wrong message, that you really are done. And, of course, we dress them up in gowns and all that kind of stuff. And I think in that way, the way we have done confirmation has been a negative in terms of the perception of the use of small catechism in the life of the church.
And that ongoing instruction, Pastor Scherberg, I want your thoughts on this. It, while it certainly can be a direct reference back to the catechism, or an intensive study of the catechism, or Luther's large catechism, which parallels the smaller one, it doesn't necessarily have to be that all the time. It's simply that the pastor is constantly, kind of constantly has one foot on the catechism. When you're playing basketball, you pivot around a point.
Sure.
And if the pastor, I remember a good friend of mine, a seminary colleague, saying, I'm a catechism pastor. You're always going to hear me quoting and citing and teaching from the catechism.
It's the touchstone that you just keep returning to, and that is exactly right, that we're going to be teaching about lots of different topics, but of course, by the time you consider, you know, the parts of the catechism, they're all going to touch on that in some way. And so I think to constantly be trying to bring back people to the ways that the catechism references this and deals with these topics is a really important thing. I know in my preaching, you know, as I have opportunity, if something connects with the small catechism, it is to just, you know, briefly say that phrase. And so those, we want it to become, you know, so second nature that those phrases evoke, you know, the broader teaching that goes with it. I mean, I think that's entirely correct.
This comes from David, who listens in Orange City, Iowa. He says, members I talk with are often surprised to learn that Luther's original small catechism did not include the questions and answers that we have today, which prompts the basic question, how much is enough? Must one size fit all? Let's deal with that question. He's talking here, of course, about the classical synodical catechism that includes, after Luther's text, a long section of questions and answers.
And that's an incredibly important insight to point out to people. And that's one of the things that can begin to change the way they view the small catechism. So many of us growing up knew it as this thick book. The small catechism is, you know, it's a small pamphlet. CPH publishes the small pamphlet we had on our rack. It's not big. And there's nothing wrong with this, the explanations that expound on it. But when we view it only as this big, thick book, that, you know, you don't use a big, thick book like that for a devotional life. And so to begin to differentiate between the text of the small catechism, well, first the text of the catechism itself, this is the basic text, and then the text of the small catechism, Luther's explanation, and to see that distinguished from further explanations on top of that is important, and that will begin to change the way people view it. In terms of, you know, how much is enough, historically the Lutheran response for Luther and those of his school was that to know the chief parts and to have the explanation, the basic understanding that's being given in the small catechism, and in particular with reference to recognizing, discerning the body and blood of Christ in the sacrament of the altar, that was enough to begin communing. And I think it's helpful in our setting to distinguish. There's a difference between the knowledge and the discernment that's necessary for for a child in the family of our congregation to begin communing, and the level of knowledge that we want, generally speaking, mature members of our congregation to have. If everybody only operates at that very basic level that an 8-year-old could grasp, we are not going to have a healthy church, and we recognize that. But the fact the 8-year-old has that level of understanding means they are more than ready to receive the sacrament of the altar. In fact, to deny them works against the very things we claim to believe. And so that would say there is a catechesis that we want to do dealing with an 8, 9, 10-year-old child. There's a catechesis that we want to do dealing with a 7th grader, 8th grader, 9th grader, in that range. We want to move them towards this deeper knowledge. And when adults commune, that's really what they're confessing. They're confessing just the sacrament of unity. I am united with these people in confessing the same thing. And that body of knowledge is, this broader understanding that we usually associate with the synodical explanation to the small catechism, those kinds of things. But you don't arrive there overnight. You're not ready for that overnight. And you don't have to have that in order for a family member of our congregation, to be communing. They are part of this fellowship. It's different than someone coming outside of the fellowship in who needs to be taught everything so they can actually confess it with us. A child growing up in our midst, under our care, who has that basic understanding of the catechism and the small catechism and can discern the body and blood of the Lord, is certainly ready and should be. And if we want them to continue on in this life of the church, the sooner we plug them in, the better off we are. And also recognize younger children are more interested. We all lament to get these 7th and 8th graders, and now you're going to shove it down your throat. Well, part of the problem is you're going to take the entire load and do it, in one fell swoop. Whereas if we started younger and we started with a much more modest goal in terms of, what they can handle and what's necessary to receive the sacrament, they like doing it. That's from personal experience I can say. This is something that is neat and they want to do it and they're interested, and that is something you can build on then and foster, as the years go on.
David in Orange City, Iowa, also had a question about, and this is something you raised yourself just a moment ago, kind of what's been the result, the connection between the way we have been doing this and what he calls abysmally small adult Bible class attendance and interest. Do you see a connection there?
Well, I think there has to be some relationship. Again, when we say and we do something that says you're done, it sends the message you're done, and there's nothing more to do. And that is a rather powerful message. And the old Adam wants to hear that. You're sort of just playing to it. The old Adam wants to be done and want nothing more to do with God's word. And so if you set up a graduation that says you're done, it's not going to help. Now, there are other factors too, obviously, in terms of what's being taught and the way it's being taught and all those kinds of things. But you have to acknowledge the fact that when your entire system of catechesis focuses on one point that says you're done, don't be surprised when people are convinced, they're really done.
Pastor Mark Serberg is our guest. We'll take another break, and when we come back on this Tuesday afternoon, January the 27th, take more of your questions and your comments as we conclude our 3-part series on the history of Christian confirmation. He's pastor of Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Marion, Illinois, author of a series of articles titled The Weird and Wacky History of Confirmation.
I like to think of the deaconess vocation as driven by two things: the love of Christ and the needs of our neighbor.
Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. James Buescher, Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the vocation of deaconess.
First, the deaconess is moved by the love of Christ, who came not to be served but to serve. Yet I think we can also see the profound needs around us: broken families, loneliness, despair. Deaconesses help the church to become a true family that manifests the love of Christ in our love for one another, and especially for those in need.
For more information on the Deaconess Studies program at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit ctsfw.edu or call Concordia Theological Seminary at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155.
Daily exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc. Athanasius, Bishop of Alexandria in the 4th century, was known for boldly confessing Jesus Christ as both true God and true man. This is what we do at St. Athanasius Lutheran Church in Vienna, Virginia, just outside Washington, D.C., continuing this historic confession of our Savior, who died for us and now comes to us in word and sacrament. If you live in the D.C. area or just visiting, come join us. For more information, find us on the web, St. Athanasius Lutheran Church.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and lay people worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy promotes confessional Lutheran theology through conferences, scholarly exchanges, and publications like Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatic Series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up for their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com. lutheracademy.com. Welcome back to Issues Etc. Pastor Mark Serberg is our guest, concluding our series with him on the history of Christian confirmation, taking your questions and your comments on this Tuesday afternoon, January the 27th. Let's go to the phone and see what Steve has to say. He's calling from his cell. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
What's your question or comment, Steve?
Yeah, I'm also a pastor in Southern Illinois with Pastor Serberg. And I was calling to see how Pastor Serberg handles it when a child who is taking communion does not continue in the catechesis classes, and maybe continues simply to come to communion a couple times a year, but does not continue in instruction.
Thank you very much, Steve. Thanks for listening up out there. What's your thoughts there, Mark?
Well, and I've spoken like a pastor because that's the reality of what can happen. We have to at least be aware of that. I think the recognition needs to be, and this really goes back to the broader issue of what does it mean to commune, that when we commune as confessors, not just as individuals receiving the body and blood of Christ, which is certainly the primary thing, but that we also commune in unity with those who are there. And so we are saying that we believe the same things. And if we are practicing early communion before confirmation or before sort of the full-blown catechesis of the kind of knowledge that we want our members to have, what we're doing is we're operating on the assumption this is a child under the household of a member. They're coming from inside this fellowship. They have the understanding right now of a child, but so they're not bringing a different understanding to it, and they are where they need to be right now. If they are communing in that way, we are doing so under the assumption that this catechesis is going to continue and that they are moving towards a fuller understanding, that we want those who are more adult congregation members and those who commune, you know, as fully as confessors, knowing what the church believes and teaches and knowing it also in relation to the other things that are out there, I mean, the contrary things that are present in other parts of the church. If we arrive at a situation where someone says, I don't want to learn that, then they're not going to be able to be a confessor in that way. And so in my own setting at Good Shepherd, when we began using the practice of early communion, it was just made very clear, and it's made very clear at the beginning, that to begin communing now is great, and it leads to catechesis. But if you tell me down the road, I don't want to learn any more about the faith, and I'm not going to learn any more about what you confess here, then you're not going to be able to continue to commune because you can't commune as a confessor. And it's really the same basic principle of someone who comes from outside, from a different fellowship, who believes something different. We're not going to allow them commune because they don't believe the same thing. If you have chosen not to learn what it is we confess, then you can't confess. In that is simply one aspect of receiving the sacrament of the altar. So we need to let people know, you know, that is part of it, and I haven't had that be an issue yet in my own pastoral practice, but it certainly could be. And we should have no difficulty saying, you know, it's really an issue of the third commandment. If you don't want to learn more about God's word and you don't want to learn what it is fully that we confess here, then you're not going to be able to commune as a confessor.
Chris listens in Chicago. Chris, thanks for being patient on the line.
All right. The conversation brought to mind that the introduction to Luther's large catechism, when we're talking about people who think they're done when they get graduated, confirmed. So if I may, I'd like to read a couple paragraphs from the large catechism.
A couple short ones, if you would, Chris.
Okay, these are paragraphs 7 and 8. Luther is in the middle of a conversation where he's sort of taking to task preachers who are content in using other books in the catechism or ignoring it altogether. He says, "But for myself, I say this, I am also a doctor and a preacher, yes, as learned and as experienced as all the people who have such assumptions and contentment, yet I ask as a child who's being taught the catechism, every morning and whenever I have time, I read and say word for word the Ten Commandments, the Creed, the Lord's Prayer, the Psalms, and such. I must still read and study them daily. I cannot master the catechism as I wish, but I must remain a child and a pupil of the catechism, and I'm glad to remain so. Yet these delicate, refined fellows would, in one reading, promptly become doctors above all doctors, know everything and need nothing. Well, this, too, is a sure sign that they despise both their office and the souls of the people. Indeed, they even despise God and his word. They do not have to fall. They have already fallen too horribly. They need to become children and begin to learn their alphabet, which they imagine they have long outgrown. Therefore, for God's sake, I beg such lazy bellies or arrogant saints to be persuaded and believe that they are truly not so learned or such great doctors as they imagine. They should never assume that they have finished learning the parts of the catechism or know it well enough in all points, even though they think that they know it ever so well. For even if they know and understand the catechism perfectly, which, however, is impossible in this life, there are still many benefits and fruits to be gained if it is daily read and practiced in thought and speech." And I'll stop there, but he goes on.
Well, let's get to
topic, scolding the catechism and scolding those who think they've graduated from it.
Let's get Pastor Scherberg's thoughts on that. He has other harsh words in the introduction of the large catechism about those who refuse to continue learning it. What are your thoughts there?
Well, you know, if we are to be Lutheran, then that is going to be our attitude, that, you know, we can't finish it. We can't be done with it. Where people think that they have, then they need to hear law, because that's just not the case.
Jen listens in Las Vegas. Jen says, "How do we as laity encourage our pastors to continue teaching the catechism beyond confirmation without becoming a nag? Or do we nag? I asked for catechism teaching and have been told that's for confirmands," which is, of course, it's not. "If the man who wrote it read it daily, I too should be reading it. And I'm trying to teach my children that the catechism is for life. I'd love to see them do that in our church, not just from their parents." What are your thoughts there, especially about a pastor who would kind of say, "No, the catechism's for the confirmants"? Exactly the problem we've been discussing for 3+ hours with you in this series.
Yes. Well, at that point, probably Luther's words are as good as any to take to them. It is a sad situation if a layperson is asking for the teaching of the small catechism and focus on the catechism in particular, and is told that, you know, that's just for the confirmands. And that, in a nutshell, that is, you know, really the problem that we're dealing with, and it is one that the practice of confirmation, the way it's come to be understood, you know, certainly has fostered. And I think, what can a layperson do except just keep asking? You know, that is the right question, and simply to let their pastor know that, no, I'm not done with it, and I don't want my children to be done with it either, and I hope you're not done with it.
Sandra in Texas now has a question about something that I wanted to get to here in the course of our concluding part of our series, and that is kind of the extra ceremonies. We discussed them early on, Pastor Scherberg.
Sure.
I've known congregations where this has been extremely elaborate. There is a a threshold and an arch of roses, growing roses through which the children would pass, that was erected at the front of the church, a real rite, a visual rite of passage, all sorts of other things, the boutonnieres, you name it. Sandra in Texas says, why do some churches put stoles on confirmands, both boys and girls?
Well, I don't know what they mean by it. You know, as we discussed, most of the trappings that we, these kinds of things that we associate with confirmation were added in during the age of rationalism. And so they are meant to ornament it and make it seem like a bigger thing. That doesn't mean that they necessarily have any good churchly teaching behind them. Now, I don't know what people think they mean by these sort of stoles. There is actually, ironically, there is some both a liturgical background that you could draw upon to try to explain it in a good way. In early Roman baptismal practice, they actually placed, and this was even on infants, these small stoles, and that was not the idea that they were somehow priests or pastors, but it was that they were part of the royal priesthood. And so that could be understood in a baptismal way. I doubt it's usually actually explained in that way, but if one wanted to try to connect it in that way and actually teach it, that would be a serviceable thing you could do with it.
What about the other additional ceremonies that have grown up? And you explained the origin of some of them in our first conversation, but what about those additional ceremonies? Would a big step toward turning this from the rite of passage disconnected from baptism that it's become, perhaps the judicial pastoral elimination of some of those extra ceremonies that have grown up around the confirmation rite?
I think that would be a very healthy development. I think less is more when it comes to the confirmation rite. And the less that we load it with all of these other accoutrements that typically really don't have any biblical symbolism or teaching or, you know, any of those kinds of things, and instead simply highlight the event itself, the less of those, you know, the better off we are.
Via Twitter, Cameron says this: First Communion and Confirmation used to be separate in the Lutheran Church. Any push to split them again?
First Communion and, well, I suppose that's what we're talking about, is the when you have the early communion before confirmation, if I understand the question correctly. And that seems to be the movement where confirmation has this association with an older age, and we are recognizing that it's not necessary for children to wait until they're that old to commune. And in fact, that was not Lutheran practice. If we're going to keep confirmation at a later age, then certainly by beginning early communion, you know, we are separating them.
Pastor Mark Zerberg is our guest, concluding our series on the history of Christian confirmation on this Tuesday afternoon, January the 27th, taking your questions and your comments as we conclude our series. Any general questions you might have about confirmation, its history, or its practice, 1-877-623-6943. Talk back at issuesetc.org or facebook.com/issuesetc. When we come back, we'll hear from Elaine. Her granddaughter was confirmed, taught with the rest of the class. Her granddaughter has autism. We'll discuss that particular wrinkle when we come back. We have a special offer for Issues Etc. Reformation Club members. If you join or upgrade your membership in our monthly or annual giving program during January or February, we'll add the new Concordia Psalter to the list of current membership benefits. T-shirts, books, broadcast transcripts, and advertising for your confessional Lutheran congregation. You can find out the benefits of being an Issues Etc. confessor, apologist, reformer, or patron at issuesetc.org. Look for the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses. Or contact Craig, 618-223-8385. Or Craig at issuesetc.org. Join or upgrade your membership in the Issues Etc. Reformation Club in January or February, and we'll send you the new Concordia Psalter along with your other premiums. The Issues Etc. Reformation Club.
Hello, this is Pastor Kevin Golden of Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, Missouri. The saints at Village Lutheran are proud to be part of the Issues Etc. 300, sharing in their Christ-centered, cross-focused proclamation of the gospel. If you find yourself in St. Louis, join us on Sundays at 8:15 and 10:45 for the Divine Service, 9:30 for Bible study and Sunday school, as we receive Christ's gifts of forgiveness, life, and salvation. Or visit us on the web at www.villagelutheranchurch.org.
Lord God, thou hast made me a pastor and teacher in the church. Pastors know they aren't perfect, but they are to be cherished and supported. Learn more at acelc.net and register for our next conference on the unbiblical removal of pastors from the office of the ministry, February 10th through 12th in Kansas City, Missouri. Pastors aren't perfect, but they are a gift from God. Learn how you can support them at acelc.net. I will certainly bring it all to destruction.
Theology for blue collar, white collar, and clerical collar. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
We Lutherans were never aided by following along with some other tradition's theological priorities and catchphrases.
Issues, Etc. regular guest, Pastor Heath Curtis, coordinator for stewardship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod on a Lutheran approach to stewardship.
Other folks are not approaching it from our good, solid Lutheran understanding of law and gospel and vocation. There's a place to talk about this in Christianity, and we have a way of talking about stewardship as Lutherans without ever using the word stewardship, if you like. I'm going to talk to you today about your vocation in your home, in your church, in your society, and how each one of these makes a claim on you, on your presence, on your support, on your prayers. That's how we should talk about this as Lutherans.
You'll find several stewardship resources at lcms.org/stewardship, lcms.org/stewardship. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for January is a great devotional resource. It's actually perfect for what we're talking about here. Luther recommends, in the preface to the Large Catechism, his larger catechism, that one make the catechism part of one's daily devotional life. That is simply a reading, a recitation, a refreshment in the teachings of the catechism if you learn them from your parents as a small child all throughout your life. And he says you do this along with the Psalms. He recommends those two explicit resources for Christian devotion, the catechism and its teachings, and the Old Testament Psalms. To that end, the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for January is a great resource. It's called the Concordia Psalter. It's just that kind of devotional resource that's meant to be opened every morning or every evening and used in your private or family devotions, also for your individual study. It's called the Concordia Psalter. Find out more about it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. You can also call Concordia Publishing House and order the Concordia Psalter, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Pastor Mark Serberg is our guest. We're concluding our series on the history of Christian confirmation. He's pastor of Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Marion, Illinois, author of a series of articles titled The Weird and Wacky History of Confirmation. This comment comes from Elaine. Elaine says, "My granddaughter has autism, and she was confirmed with the rest of the class. Our pastor said that we cannot know how much she understands, but God knows." What are your thoughts there on that kind of, we're talking here about the exception, the exceptional case, aren't we?
Well, when we have children with special needs, obviously the pastor needs to work with them based on their abilities. And I think when we realize that the level of knowledge and understanding that is required to commune in a way that's faithful with what the Scriptures teach us, is not this full-blown level we've kind of assumed, you know, has to be present all the time. And I think the very premise of early communion really addresses or speaks to those kinds of situations as well, that there is a level of knowledge and understanding that is perfectly faithful and is perfectly fine for children to reach and have to begin communing. And so, you know, every one of those situations is different, and you know, that's where the pastor has to work with the child and the parents, and you know, get a sense of what they're able to do. But you know, these are questions that pastors deal with all the time, and we deal with it on the other end of life too. I mean, many pastors will tell you the experience of dealing with members who have Alzheimer's and dementia. You know, and the question becomes, well, you know, can I continue to give this person the Lord's Supper? Are they discerning it? So, you know, in the fallen world, we do face these issues, and I think when we recognize, at least at the beginning, that with children, it is not that they have to master the entire backside of the catechism, the synodical catechism, the commune, that opens up avenues to very faithfully allow children to receive the sacrament and to do so in a way that is entirely faithful to what that gift requires.
Scott in Illinois proposes this scenario. Let's say a child in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod has been admitted to the sacrament of the altar at his home congregation. That is, he's been instructed, as you've mentioned here, Pastor Serberg, in the Ten Commandments Creed, Lord's Prayer, but has not been through the rite of confirmation. An opportunity arises for the child and his family to receive the sacrament at another Lutheran Church Missouri Synod congregation, perhaps while traveling. If that congregation does not practice early communion before confirmation, what is the better course for the family? To abstain from the sacrament for a week? Or to request the sacrament for themselves and their child who's already been to the sacrament? What does either option confess? A very astute question, Scott. Thanks for listening in Illinois.
That is a very good question, and it's something that we've encountered you know, in our own family life, because our younger children commune because of the practice here. For starters, whenever you visit, you should talk to the pastor and let them know you're there. So to begin with, you know, that should always be what you seek to do. Sometimes that's, you know, not practical, the pastor's around, but whenever possible, you should seek out the pastor anyway when you're visiting. If you are in a congregation where they have early communion, and most likely you have used the rite of early communion before confirmation, you know, from the LSB agenda, you simply need to go to that pastor and explain that the child's been, you know, instructed and examined and communes in that setting. I would hope, recognizing that and recognizing the pastoral care that this pastor of another congregation has provided, that the pastor would, you know, allow the child to commune. As a visitor, you need to be sensitive that, you know, because of the particular tradition and practice in that congregation, you know, that may present difficulties for the pastor, and if he, you know, feels that wouldn't be something in his setting he can do, then we just need to be understanding. So, I mean, to go and ask, I think, is the appropriate thing to do. I would hope pastors would feel that, number one, they want to and also can permit a child to commune in that setting. I have not run into a difficulty with that. But, you know, when you ask, you also just need to understand that every congregation is different, and pastors are dealing with the people they actually have there. And if, you know, he in his pastoral judgment thinks that's just not something that's, you know, fly in his setting, you know, then we just need to be understanding. And then, you know, the question is, we offer the sacrament every Sunday. That doesn't mean we have to commune every Sunday. And so then it's just a matter of, you know, as a family, do we just not commune that Sunday, or, you know, do we not have the one child commune? You know, you need to decide those issues. But I think you can work it out in a way that if you ask the question, I think most of the time the answer you'll get will be, you know, that yes, commune. And you just have to be open to the possibility that if the pastor says no, you put the best construction on things, and there are probably issues you're not aware of there, and just accept that.
The one little lesson I've learned on this front is that with more and more congregations, and I think rightly so, making First Communion go along with home and parish instruction that is not part of the rite of confirmation, that is earlier communion as we've been calling it, which our parish actually does as in kind of a halfway, a good compromise. When speaking with parents that have children there, instead of asking them before the service, are your children confirmed? Some of them are going to say no. That's not the right question sometimes. It's
yes,
do your children
yeah.
Do your children commune?
Yes.
Because if I ask, are they confirmed, and they say no, we might not be actually speaking the same language.
Do they
commune? And then they can say, well, of course they commune, but they haven't been confirmed yet. Okay, fine. Welcome to the Lord's table.
Right. That's an excellent point, and I think just one that we need to be aware that there is a shift that's taking place. I mean, the very fact that the rite is in the agenda now indicates that, and you do. You run into more and more congregations if that's the case, and that question, you know, based on this shift in practice, is probably not the right question to ask anymore, and instead to ask, you know, do they commune? That's a great point.
Vernon says, does confirmation still matter? What does Pastor Sherberg suggest for pastors and laity alike to make confirmation matter in today's church?
Well, that would go to what do you mean by confirmation? Do you mean the right, specifically, you know, on a date that you show up and do? Or when you use the word confirmation, are you talking about the whole process by which we catechize and teach the faith and prepare people to receive the sacrament and then continue to teach after that? If you mean the whole process, of course it matters. It has to matter. The church can't continue without it. If we're focused on the rite, I think we can make a case that, you know, it causes more problems than it solves. And you just need to recognize that for a large chunk of the Lutheran Church history in its early years, you know, that there was no rite of confirmation. So clearly it doesn't have to matter. And I think that is, I mean, this discussion is exactly the kind of discussion that we need to be having and begin to assess, is this a good thing? Do we want to continue it in the way that we have? It's a very, very, you know, ingrained thing. It's not something that would change overnight, even if you wanted to. But at least to begin to distinguish that there is a rite, and then there is the whole process of catechesis that may lead to the rite and then lead after the rite. And those are two different things. We can have the catechesis, and we can have people begin to commune in a way they've been examined and instructed and all those things without a rite of confirmation. That's not in any way necessary. And so then the question is, what do we think the rite means? The things that go on in the rite, what are they saying to people? And are those the things that it's teaching and saying to people consistent with what we claim to believe about baptism, catechesis, and the sacrament of the altar?
Karen listens in St. Charles. Karen, thanks for being patient.
Hi. I think Pastor Sherberg's comments applied somewhat to my question, but I have had trouble rectifying close communion with early communion. How can we say these children not confirmed in the faith may commune, but someone else not confirmed in the faith, an adult, cannot? And I'm a proponent of close communion. I'm not so sure about early communion because of this.
Karen, thank you very much. That's an excellent question. Pastor Sherberg.
Well, that is an excellent question. And I'll be honest, I'm a very strong proponent of close communion, and I've written articles about that. And that was one of my hang-ups with early communion, I'll be honest with you. And as I continue to work with the topic, what I came to recognize is that we're not saying the same thing about a child who's a member of our congregation, who's being raised in our midst, and the individual who's coming from outside. And there's a significant difference between the fact that this child is here inside our fellowship and we have someone who is coming from outside. When they commune, they are not, as a member of a family or a congregation, knowingly holding anything that is contrary to what we believe. What they believe are all the things, insofar as they understand them, all the things we believe. They're not knowingly believing things that are contrary to it. When we have people coming from outside the fellowship, now we have a question of, and as you use the example of the adult, what do they believe? And on these various issues, do they believe things and hold opinions and beliefs that are contrary to what we confess that would bring division to the altar? So that really becomes a very different situation altogether as we address the adult. You know, once you have this full-blown knowledge that's possible, then we have a whole range of things we need to find out. You know, do we believe the same thing, and what do you believe about that? And that becomes the basic issue in terms of close communion. You know, so often in the past, there was a great focus on, you know, simply do they believe it's the body and blood of Christ, and that's certainly the primary thing. But the great sort of advance or increase in understanding that has occurred since the 1990s really is this emphasis on the way that 1 Corinthians 10:16-17 and the horizontal or the corporate dimension of the sacrament of the altar really informs our close communion practice, that it's the sacrament of unity, that we don't bring division there. the child who is a member of this fellowship and a member of a family, they're not bringing division because they believe what they believe is what they've been taught. Now, they may not know everything yet, but they don't believe anything contrary to it. That's a very different question than when I have an adult coming from outside the fellowship, and then I need to address issues of, do we confess the same thing? And so as long as we have children who are in the family of a congregation member, part of the fellowship, I don't think we have that issue. And that also is where it becomes, it goes back to an earlier question, well, what if the child says, well, I don't want to do any more of that you know, catechesis stuff, at which point then we need to say, well, if you don't want to become a member who can confess what we confess at the sacrament of the altar, then we're going to have to arrive at the point that you're not able to commune as a confessor. And so that's where the issue of coming to a knowledge level that enables you to confess as we expect someone of your age to confess dovetails very, very closely with the topic of close communion. And I think it's right to ask that question. I also think that there's a really good answer that can be provided.
And one of the things I would say, I don't see a conflict between close communion and this early First Communion, simply because that child is not going to be admitted unless they know what it is and why they come, unless the parents or pastor have instructed them at least in the Ten Commandments, Creed, and Lord's Prayer. They have a public confession of faith that is perfectly in line with that of the congregation, and so they are full communicant members. Someone coming from the outside needs to be, you know, examined and questioned with regard to that. If they have that public confession of faith, welcome. If they do not, then it's really comparing, in my mind, apples and oranges there.
Oh, yeah, I would agree.
Let's take a break. By the way, these articles that Pastor Mark Serberg have written, they are extensive. There are 10 of them. It's actually 10-part articles of the weird and wacky history of confirmation are right at your fingertips. You can go to our website, issuesetc.org, click Listen on Demand, and read for yourself the weird and wacky history of confirmation. You will learn a lot by doing it. Pastor Mark Serberg is pastor of Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Marion, Illinois. When we come back, 10 more minutes with him on the history of Christian confirmation. Should the rite as we have it today, simply be eliminated? We'll take some of your other questions and comments as well. You can sing and recite the church's hymn book, the Psalms, using modern English and new musical settings in the new Concordia Psalter. Check it out at issuesetc.org, or you can purchase the Concordia Psalter by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Make the Concordia Psalter part of your devotional life this year. 1-800-325-3040. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January, the new Concordia Psalter.
Christianity once turned the world upside down. Is it still true? Join us for the Village Lutheran Lectures on Christianity and Culture on February the 7th, 2 to 4 p.m., as Dr. Alvin Schmidt reminds us of the Church's rich heritage of turning the world upside down and invites us to continue that very thing today. Join us at Village Lutheran Church, 9237 Clayton Road in suburban St. Louis.
Lutheran. It's not a label, it's a confession. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. St. John Lutheran, Springfield, Pennsylvania. Zion Lutheran, Detroit, Michigan. St. Paul's Lutheran, Long Beach, California. All Saints Lutheran, Charlotte, North Carolina. Redeemer Lutheran, Colorado Springs, Colorado. Shepherd of the Lake Lutheran, Garrison, Minnesota. Emmanuel Lutheran, Kansas City, Missouri. And Holy Cross Lutheran, St. Genevieve, Missouri. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, and click support. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. Journal, issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin on this Tuesday afternoon. We're concluding our series, last 10 minutes of our three-part series on the history of Christian confirmation with Pastor Mark Serberg, taking your questions and your comments. To that end, Lawrence in Australia has this one. He says, for someone coming to the Lutheran Church from evangelicalism with children already ages 6 through 9, should we consider baptism straight away or wait to combine with confirmation similar to adult baptism occurring on Easter Day? That's an interesting question. Thanks for listening in Australia, Lawrence. Pastor Serberg.
That is a really good question, actually. My general sense is that where people know what the gift of baptism is, they and understand what God is doing there, they want to receive it, and they want to receive it for their children. And so I actually have encountered this exact scenario where, you know, it would be neat and all of the rich symbolism that ties in with the vigil of Easter and doing baptism at that time. But to say to someone, no, you have to wait when, you know, they want all of the things that are given in baptism is a very difficult thing to do, and I don't think makes a lot of sense. So, I mean, I think, you know, certainly my preference would be if someone wants to be baptized and they've been taught what it means, and of course that needs to be tied with the teaching of what the gift is, to put it off to a later time is not necessarily the best thing. So to put it off to Easter, we often baptize, you know, at the end of a whole run of catechesis. I mean, that's a very good practice, but I've had situations where, you know, people already came, they knew what baptism was. We actually did the teaching about baptism, and, you know, it just didn't make sense to withhold the gift. So I think there can be some flexibility there. But where people have been taught what baptism is, and they believe what the small catechism says about it, I think it's kind of difficult to tell them, no, you can't have that gift.
Stephen in Columbus, Nebraska says, in my day, confirmation was a rite that showed you were outwardly prepared to participate in the Lord's Supper. In these days, where there is rampant open communion, or at least less open communion, do we even need to bother with confirmation? That's kind of the question hanging over our whole thing. Can we eliminate the rite without doing any long-term harm to the church?
You will need something. Let's say we just did away with confirmation. You would still need something that says, this individual has been instructed, and since we're talking about, you know, moving towards adulthood, can confess in the way we want individuals to confess in the life of the church. And so you're going to have something that says that, I at least as I've thought about this. You can't completely do away. Now, that doesn't have to be confirmation. I mean, my opinion would be we'd be doing ourselves a service if we make less of a deal about, you know, the completion rather than making this huge deal that you've completed. And so, you know, if you had, I mean, in my ideal world, you'd have a catechesis with, you know, 7 and 8 year olds as they prepare to receive the sacrament of the altar first time, and then you'd have catechesis later on in 7th, 8th, 9th grade, somewhere in there, so that intellectually we can kind of teach them the fuller things that we want. At the end of that process, there needs to be some kind of acknowledgement of the congregation that has happened, but I think I'd like it to be, as you know, rather understated. Let's not make a huge deal like they're done. We want to acknowledge that, you know, the pastor has fulfilled his duty and they're ready in these ways, and you need some kind of recognition within your church that, you know, this person has been instructed in this way. But to turn it into a huge deal as this terminal event, that just simply brings you back to the very problems that, you know, confirmation has become.
The final question comes from Nathan in Williamsburg, Iowa. Kind of where do we go from here? Having given several insights as to what the rite of confirmation entails, what should the next step of our particular confession, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, be to resolve the issues with confirmation? If you had, say, 2 minutes here, a minute and a half, actually, and you only have a minute and a half, to okay. make some suggestions, what would they be, Pastor Serberg?
The first would be to actively pursue First Communion early communion before confirmation, because that will foster the sacramental life, that fosters all the things we claim to believe, that begins to shift the focus away from confirmation as this end rite. And then the second thing would be to emphasize that, you know, catechesis is something that must be ongoing, and we need to work it into our church life in a way so that it doesn't just happen once and it's done. And if that is a matter of the children do it a period, and then later, and you know, later as young adults, they do another period and at least try to space it out, and then to work the small catechism and the catechism itself into the life of the congregation to try to send that message. I mean, that's the other great project that we have to undertake.
Karen, in St. Charles, Missouri, if you would send us your mailing address, talkback@issuesetc.org, we will send you this 5-volume commentary on Luther's catechisms from Albrecht Peters. Thanks to everybody for the questions or their comments during our series with Pastor Serberg. Pastor Mark Serberg is pastor of Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Marion, Illinois, and author of a series of articles titled The Weird and Wacky History of Confirmation. Mark, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Folks, if you've benefited from our 3-part series on Christian confirmation, please consider joining the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. That's our monthly or annual giving program. Now, membership benefits include T-shirts, books, broadcast transcripts, and advertising for your confessional Lutheran congregation. If you join or upgrade your membership January or February, we will send you the new Concordia Psalter along with your other benefits. Find out more about the Issues Etc. Reformation Club at our homepage, issuesetc.org. Look for the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll talk with Molly Ziegler-Hemingway about the Supreme Court and same-sex marriage, and we'll discuss how to avoid funeral faux pas with Pastor Hans Feeney. Luther himself says, "Can we finish learning in 1 hour what God himself cannot finish teaching? He is engaged teaching this," that is, he's talking about the truths of the catechism, "he is engaged teaching this from the beginning of the world to the end. All prophets, together with all saints, have been busy learning it and have ever remained students and must continue to be students." I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
How does confessional Lutheran theology measure up against popular yet false worldviews, ideas, and religions? Find out at the San Antonio Biblical Worldview Conference, Friday, February 6th and Saturday, February 7th at Faith Lutheran Church in San Antonio, Texas. Meet and hear regular guests Chris Rosebro, Dr. Joel Heck, and others at the San Antonio Biblical Worldview Conference, February 6th and 7th in San Antonio. flc-sa.org, flc-sa.org.
O morning star, O morning star, shine with
Listen to the best of the Church's music for the Epiphany season at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the Epiphany season, 24/7, LutheranPublicRadio.org.